and welcome to the Regrettable Century. We are back with Jason, Ben, and Kevin, and a special guest that... Oh, wait, and Chris also, sorry. And a special guest that we had on just short of a year ago, I think, that I meant to have on much sooner than now, but PhD and baby got in the way. Welcome. Say hello to John. John, the Lit Crit guy.
Or John Green.
John Greenway, as it says on the front of this book. So now we know your last name.
Yeah, they wouldn't let me publish the book with just a Twitter handle, which would have been cool. But I guess we can't have nice things, but like, you know, fine, whatever.
You spend all this time coming up with your own name, you know, building a reputation and a brand around it, and they make you use your your government name.
Yeah, it's almost like writing a book and posting are not quite the same thing, even though they're kind of the same thing, right?
It's almost like that.
Wait, well, is it Greenway or Greenaway? Because I was pronouncing that syllable.
Yes, that's correct. Greenaway.
Yeah,
Greenaway.
Greenaway. All right.
Yeah.
Sorry, John.
That's the not yet green.
Yeah, the green, the forest is over there. The green is away.
The forest is imminent.
Yeah. Anyway, so we are here to talk about John's new book. It's a pamphlet length book, right? It's about, 50 something pages, right?
But yeah, it's actually 40 pages.
Well, it's a primer on utopian philosophy, an introduction to the work of Ernst Bloch, who we're all fans of here on the show. And we actually talked about Ernst Bloch on our last episode that we did with you, John.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just say, congratulations. This is awesome. It's very accessible. Yeah, I think everybody needs to read this. This will be added to our our reading list of things that we think are
must reads. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think part of what makes it so useful is it's very short, very readable. Like you could sit down and an afternoon or something and just breeze right through it. Yet at the same time, it's not superficial.
It's, right, it's dense.
It's dense and it's packed full of it's very rich, text while still being extremely readable, which is an extremely rare talent to be able to put something like that together. I definitely recommend people pick it up and read it.
Yeah, I think that when I was in my 20s, I would take books like The Case for Socialism or The Meaning of Marxism and be like, this is a must read. Everybody has to read this. And I think this is now my new version of that. Everybody must read this.
I like how you put 1,600 pages of The Principle of Hope into 10? Something like that. That is a feat, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, it's just edit, right? It's like,
right.
it can't all be good. Wrong. That's not true. It's all extremely good. Well, I just wanted to say kind of like two very quick things, which is like, I sort of, I'm accused of being slightly contrarian sometimes when I say that I am not a philosopher, and this is not a book of philosophy, right? This is not a book that's written for people who are already interested in philosophy, right? This is, and it's because I don't think that philosophy is this kind of like philosophy is like this discourse of the master, right? It's this credentialed activity, and I don't have those credentials, and I don't really think that that's really where philosophy is kind of found. And there's a good line by Johann Sievers, who is a philosopher, talking about Bloch and Bloch's philosophical methodology, which is if you abstract philosophy away from life, you're no longer really doing philosophy at all. You know, and Sievers puts it that critique has become uncritical. Philosophy is a kind of lived activity. It is not It's not academic. It's not scholastic. And so, like, the whole point of the book is precisely to kind of try and bring the resources of Bloch to people who are not philosophers, because they will probably recognize in Bloch someone who's a bit more like them than just like, this is why I try and avoid things like footnotes and overly like academic kind of styles of writing in it, because it's supposed to be short. It's supposed to be quick, but it's also supposed to be like, actually philosophy is not really found in academia. It's not found in the kind of like the discourse of the master. Right, thought is the very kind of like stuff and reality of like lived experience, and this is because Bloch has that like old it's a slightly old-fashioned, very German idealist conception of what philosophy is, which is like philosophy is inextricable from life. And if you do that abstraction of putting it into, you know, the academic discourse, in a way, you've kind of done a disservice to it. So this is, this is a primer. It is supposed to start something for someone else. This is not the final way of reading Bloch. It's probably not an uncontroversial argument if you're like a Marxologist, or if you're super into Bloch, there'll be stuff that's in this book that you probably won't really agree with. But if you're super into Bloch, you're probably a philosopher in an academic institution. This book is not for you. This is something to kind of pass on to someone and just be like, hey, see what this kind of sparks for you, right?
Yeah, it's a pamphlet. It's meant to be like, it's actually a call for reorienting towards an actionable political sort of view of the world that's based in the rediscovery of utopianism, right? Mm-hmm. So
yes, like, you know, right. What I think that's what's really meant by. Up to this point, philosophers have only interpreted the world, but the point is to change it. That's not meant to say, oh, philosophy is bad. That's dumb. That's for people to just think.
Right.
But it's meant to be like, philosophy is about life, which is for living, not for just thinking about.
Right.
So I was at an event with a friend of mine called Billy, and she sort of introduced the book and very kindly said that, like, really the book, and I totally agree that this is what I did, even if I didn't know it consciously at the time, this book kind of is insisting on, there's really only one important question, right? There's really only one, which is, how do you live rightly? How do you live, right? And if you get away from that question, the utopian philosophy is like inextricable from that. Like, that's really the only, like, all of our kind of like clever philosophical discourse and all of our knowledge, it really is, if you stop asking the question of like, how do you live in the world, then you're no longer really doing, like, you're not really thinking properly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, we said, like, it's early on when you say it, it's about a rethinking of our politics and a complete restructuring of philosophy from the ground up. I actually think that this book is probably the best in that effort, in that sort of direction, that I've, at least that I'm aware of. And I'm not just saying that because we're talking to the author, but we're talking to the author because I'm saying that, you know?
There we go. So I think, like, right as when I was having technical difficulties earlier, you were talking about Bloch, why Bloch isn't more read and discussed on the Anglophone left. Mm-hmm. And I think that getting into that and why Bloch is important before we start digging into like the meat of the book might be like interesting to do. So yeah. You said you have a theory. I'm interested to hear that theory.
Yeah. Bloch's writing career basically goes over about 50 or 60 years of work. He starts writing when he is a young man, and he's writing all the way up, like he's finishing the editorial work on his 20 volumes of complete works just before he dies. A lot of it is not translated into English. There's probably about 6, 7, or 8 really good books in English, translations, all of which could probably benefit from something like this, right? Every, like, atheism and Christianity could do with something like this. I think I could write something double the length about the principle of hope. But Bloch is, I think the first thing that people stumble over is the style. I think that the translators to the principle of hope are maybe unintentionally being very funny when they point out that, like, Bloch is very literary, and that's why Marxists don't like him. It's true. It's true. Like, he loves poetry. He loves, like, art. He loves music. He loves. He seems to kind of know everything. Right. He's like this kind of intellectually omnivorous kind of figure. But he writes in a very particular style. It's very expressionistic. It's very self and, like, self-referential and very intertextual. I think he's actually a very beautiful writer. Like, there are paragraphs of Block which are just incredible writing. But I think the style is maybe the first stumbling block. Secondly is, like, reception of his work as being, like... Habermas has a kind of quite damning critique of Block, where he says that he's a Marxist Schelling, you know, talking about Schelling, the German philosopher. But what Habermas means is, like, he's pre-critical, right? He hasn't gone through Kantianism. He isn't doing philosophy properly. I don't think that's true at all, but I think that's probably a kind of, like, a criticism that lingers in the kind of philosophical ether, as it were.
I would also consider that praise anyways.
Yeah.
Right. Which I think you do as well, John. You kind of turn it on its head the way that Jameson turns the critique of Marxism as a religion on its head.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. It's like, maybe you're right, and that's why he's cool. But also I think a big issue is in the reception of Block. So Block was very, very close to particularly Benjamin, Adorno, and Lukács, all of whom are very well known in kind of like Anglophone leftist theory circles, but all of whom were kind of writing in response to or with or against Block. Theory of the Novel by Lukács is very famous, but like it's very heavily influenced by Block. But they were all kind of like received philosophically and politically in the Anglophone world. Block, on the other hand, was received mostly by theologians first. So Jürgen Moltmann, Paul Tillich, right. they took Block and their work kind of like put it back into a much more explicitly theological context. And then it kind of went into sort of a certain tradition of American Protestant academic theology. And I think Block has suffered for that, right? So he doesn't write like anybody else. He's often seen as not really doing philosophy at all, and he kind of has like not really been taken seriously beyond a very narrow intellectual circle. And so what I'm trying to insist on really is that like we live in a very kind of critical, philosophically negative age, post 2008, right? Yeah. I think something I just wrote about over on my blog is like we've all kind of there's this idea of like Fisher's capitalist realism being the kind of generationally defining text. And that sort of like negation is good, right? You have to be philosophically negative. And I think it's very easy for that to kind of get misread into being kind of a miserabilist. But the point that I want to make is that Fisher is a utopian. Mark Fisher is a utopian.
Yeah.
The very final line of capitalist realism is from a situation in which nothing is possible, suddenly anything can happen again. Yes. Which is like a kind of audaciously jaw-dropping statement to try and make. So Block is a really good model if you recognize that actually that philosophical negation is the first step, right? The second step is the utopian demand of something better to replace it. So I think, I don't know, my sort of theory is that post 2008, we've all gotten very good at critique and negation. And Block, who is like this, like loquacious, lyrical, passionate, culturally engaged, like bombshell of a writer, people just go, oh, well, it's not doing the right things.
Right.
But I think we are in desperate need of this kind of catalyzing force within his work.
I think that the sort of hope that Block talks about is like so different from the kind of empty, hollow, let's say the pastiche or the facade of hope that passes for optimism today, which is why the shorthand anyways of what we talk about is pessimism. But I think sometimes our pessimism is kind of misunderstood, or even we kind of lean a little bit too much into it and forget the dialectical part. But also the dialectical is insufficient sometimes because nobody knows what that means, you know? And it's no good, really, to just insist that, oh, yeah, well, the problem is that you don't know what it means. Because, like, okay, I mean, I do think that's true. And I do want people to know what it means. But I also would like to be propagandist enough to utilize what actually moves people. And so I think that this is a huge plug for this book. I feel like what Block is talking about is kind of what we really mean. So it really, I think, is like really something that somebody that we should have been familiar with all our lives and definitely should start being way more familiar with now.
So John mentioned the adopting the negation without continuing that forward with through the negation of the negation.
Right.
And that is would be the dialectical part of that dialectical pessimism, right? The idea that what we're pessimistic about is things getting better if we keep doing the same things that we've always been doing. Mm-hmm. And if we rely on the piecemeal changes or the little things that we could do to influence the Democrats or the Labor Party or whatever, you know. And if we're not looking to smash everything and start over, if we have no utopian vision, we have no faith in that. There's no hope in things as they exist right now. But in there being no hope, in the release of hope in the mundane and the status quo, there is the birth of hope in something that is beyond that. So
yeah,
that to me, I think that like whenever I was reading through your little introduction here, I was just like, okay, so what John's talking about is what we mean by dialectical pessimism. And that's what, you know, that we get that from Benjamin, we get that from Ernst Bloch, but they just didn't call it that. Because I think that if you're in a like somewhat revolutionary adjacent age, like what Benjamin and Bloch are writing in, you know, you've got just over the horizon, it's possible to imagine that is a utopian horizon, right? And now, so far removed from that, in a post-hope era, right? It kind of seems like it makes no sense to be optimistic, and that optimism, any optimism that you do see your comrades on the left displaying, seems false. It seems like a coping mechanism just to get by, rather than any actual belief that things can get better. So. I understand the eschewing the sort of like nihilistic pessimism the way that Bloch does, but I think that what we mean by it is exactly what Bloch means by actually having hope.
Bloch is doing this, and you're pointing to it in the beginning of your book, distinguishing between hope and optimism, and rescuing hope is part of rescuing utopia, and not only kind of a determinate, but a processional utopia, right? Something that is in process at all times and becoming. And you say that matter is also a potential becoming. So I feel like that is what is lost in the sort of the way that we relegate, you know, the negative and whatever else to our discourse around our political horizons. It's like, what is the actual process of hope in the darkness?
Yeah, there's so much to kind of draw out what both of you have said. I think firstly, Bloch's theory of subjectivity is really interesting. Like his basic kind of like existential point about being a subject is that in many ways we're not even human yet. Right, he calls it the darkness of the lived moment. He says like we know that something is kind of missing within us, and it is this that kind of like throws us out of ourselves into the world. And the whole point of Bloch's focus on process is like, are you always prepared to go back to the beginning and start again? Are you always prepared to go back? Just when you think you've gotten to somewhere, are you prepared to give up and go all the way back to the beginning and try again? And I think the problem of optimism is that it thinks it's arrived at its final destination, right?
Yeah.
You know, you go, well, we did it. And the Blochian kind of response is to go, well, what next? Oh, can't you just enjoy what's next? Like, what's the new thing that kind of like throws us out of ourselves again? Because something that's come up in other discussions around this book is Huey P. Newton's notion of revolutionary suicide. So Newton is not like advocating some like annihilationist death drive, but actually making a really utopian Blochian point, which is that under present conditions, we are dead. Like, this isn't life, right? This life has not been allowed to kind of like to be what it is. So it's like what we are hoping for, what we are striving towards, is the conditions of being that would allow kind of human history to kind of start properly. You know, post-revolution, you go, history is sort of, is both kind of redeemed and started for the first time. And this is where Block connects to Benjamin, right? Not even the dead will be safe, right, in history.
Right.
So it isn't just about redeeming the present situation, but it's about that kind of those centuries of failure and struggle and kind of striving and all of those utopian dreams. They were the struggle to get us to the place where we could begin, right? The place that there could be an actual, genuine humanness starting to kind of emerge. And to very quickly sort of flesh that out, it's like, this is why I think optimism, I'm not optimistic at all about the present situation. I don't think anybody should be, but I am hopeful. And I think that's a difference that's like incredibly important to insist upon.
Yeah. Right. That distinction is precisely, you know, the point of what we've always tried to insist upon with the asserting the word dialectical in front of pessimism is, you know, what that's doing is it's gesturing toward the concept containing the kernel of its opposite within it. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of, you know, the absence of a pessimism could be seen as a deluded optimism that, you know, everything's going to be great and wonderful if we just, you know, rally and charge forward, and we're all going to lead the revolution, and the masses will join us if we just, you know, sell three more papers that call for a mass strike or whatever. But then there's also, you know, the sort of hard-nosed realism of a true cynic who says utopia is not possible. Get your head out of the clouds. Let's be realistic. Let's just accept the limits of what is possible and act within them. And a pessimism. I would want to say what we were trying to emphasize with this dialectical pessimism is to say that contained in this pessimism is the refusal to let go of that hope for the possibility of the future while living in while refusing to live in delusion. And I think a Blockian hope contains that same dialectical move in it that's what makes it distinct from optimism, is it refuses to embrace a delusion or, you know, a cynical pessimism
or a spectacle.
Yes, exactly. This is because Block is a Hegelian, right? And this is like, people go, oh, he isn't philosophical. It's all just like, it's all kind of tub thumping sermons from Block. And it's like, no, he is a very committed and not at all like systematic or dogmatic, but is a Hegelian philosopher.
He doesn't even like Chumbawamba. Sorry about that.
more people should, unironically. But yeah, like this idea of like, oh, you just have to be realistic. There's a great quote from Block that I really love, where he says that like, as long as the universe is not completely closed, right? As long as the universe is not a completely fixed system, then no objection to utopia can be raised on purely factual grounds. It's like if you call yourself a realist, but you aren't being realistic. You are not approaching. This is why it's necessary to do this reconstruction of philosophy, because it's like, do you think the kind of universe or existence is just this kind of given thing? You know, this series of flat phenomenal objects that are always already the thing that you need them to be. And Block says you've fundamentally misunderstood the nature of existence and kind of materialism full stop, because matter is not this inert kind of lump. It has, entelechy. It has an end in it. So this idea of like, this is something I very briefly talk about Jordan Peterson in this book, and for his arguments against utopia, is like the world is just the way it is, and the whole point of Block's philosophy is like, no, the world is not just the way it is, right? Everything about about history and about philosophy and about culture and about politics tells us the world is constructed, but contains within it many possible other worlds which have yet to find kind of full expression. And our dissatisfaction, this kind of like this, you know, I steal this quote from my friend Kyle Kern, who introduced me to this from Eugene Debs, that almost intuitive sense that the world is not right. Like, that's a very famous Debsian, like, speech. And it's like, you're onto something, right? These little flickering intuitions where you go, hang on, does it really have to be like this? That's where you actually start taking, that's when you actually start engaging with reality properly, not this kind of ideological construct of like, just be realistic.
Right. And this entelechy that you, I wasn't familiar with the, I haven't read as Aristotle, but that within all things is a kind of potential becoming. Gluck is using that to answer the sort of liberal establishment cynicism Kevin referenced, and also this kind of materialism as idealism that is sort of dialectical materialism of the 20th century, you know, in which there's this inverse telos or schematic in which, you know, the nature is a different given than the the one we're taught.
Well, yeah, like I'm reading Alexander Dugin, and like there's lots of stuff that's not good, but some of it's really good. And one of his main criticisms is of the basically what we call diamat, right? And I just think, like, man, if only stuff like what Bloch was talking about was just more popular among Marxists. It wasn't like, not to say if it was the only thing, just if it was in the mix and it wasn't like just kind of kept in very small circles. I just can't imagine how much more rich, how much better all of our thinking could just be.
Right. Yeah. That Jason and Varn are doing a, and Sean KB from Antifada are doing a close reading of
extremely Dugin. Close.
Yeah, very close reading of Dugin's, fourth political theory, and it's on all of our Patreons if anyone who is listening to this episode wants to go listen to that.
I actually had a thought about what you said before about the ways in which Bloch has been kind of a sort of shunted aside because he's not philosophical enough by people like Habermas, but then also on the other hand he's also kind of shunted aside or ignored by all the officialdom of the communist world, like capital C,
right,
for really the opposite reasons, because he's too philosophical. And it kind of reminds me of like early Trotsky, this, I wrote this down because I wanted to make sure we said it. It's like 1901. I don't even remember what exactly he's talking about, but he says, here I am, your long awaited 20th century, your future. No, replies the unhumbled optimist. You are only the present. And I just, when I first read that, it was like, when I was like 19, and I was so moved by that. And then later on, I was counseled by all the older Trotskyists, like, oh, that was when Trotsky was not really a fully materialist yet. I was like, oh.
Right, so, right.
Yeah, so, like, Bloch has this problem for most of his career, right? For most of his life, which is, like, when he's a student, he meets Lukács, and Lukács teaches him Hegel, and he teaches Lukács, like, Kierkegaard. And Lukács says it's like, you met someone who made you believe like the classic German philosophy was still alive. And the two of them kind of have a kind of like breaking of paths. Lukács ends up in the Hungarian communist government and is much more kind of orthodox and quite stringent Marxist-Leninist. And says that Bloch is kind of a revisionist. He's a mystic. He's a theologian. He's not doing Marxism anymore. When he leaves Germany because of World War II, he is actually very close with a lot of the Frankfurt School, with Horkheimer and Adorno particularly, but he doesn't end up getting very much work from them, mostly because Horkheimer particularly was thought he was too close to the communists. He's too communist. He's an apologist for the Soviet Union. He goes back to the DDR. He's ready to, you know, be a good socialist intellectual to kind of build socialism. And he sort of starts lecturing and publishing about arid materialism and the need for like a complete rethinking of the relationship between Marxism, society, and religion, particularly where he's accused of being a revisionist. He's accused of corrupting the young. Quite a lot of his students are actually thrown in jail. He's he is forcibly retired and is not allowed to publish anymore in the DDR. And then in 61, he ends up in West Germany and decides to stay. And initially, he's seen as something as, of a joke, right? He's this, at the very best, he's like a nostalgic reminder of something. And at the very worst, he is this apologist for Stalinism and a kind of like someone who's come to their senses too late. But like, he's a heretic. Right, he's a heretic, and like the thing that reading Bloch will make you realize is like so is Marxism. Marxism is a heresy,
right.
But because heresy is the ground in which new thought comes into the world, and it's only heresy until it wins, and then it becomes dogma. Right, that's when it's no longer a heresy if it becomes successful.
At one point, Christianity was a heresy.
Yeah,
That's why he loves Christianity.
What is Pauline Christianity but a heretical midrash, you know?
Yeah. The best thing about religion is it makes for good heretics, is what Bloch says.
Right.
So, like, he is always this kind of, like, out-of-place thinker and is always kind of, like, sort of derided as being not the one who fits in within a scheme. But Bloch is, like, I think the kind of response is, like, that's exactly the point, right? Do we need an entire generation of Ernst Blochs? No, but we needed one. You needed one to be the one who was like, actually, what comes next? Are we always prepared to kind of go out again into the world? And that's not just an existential thing. That's not just a philosophical thing. That's about the grounds of political struggle as well.
So John, you quote Bloch, I'm forgetting exactly where, but he's responding to this sort of what we might call presentism, which I just learned about from a young German friend yesterday. Bloch says, we live surrounded by possibility, not merely by presence. In the prison of mere presence, we could not even move nor even breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of feel like this rational sort of end of history presentism has moved on into the left. And this is sort of like this, in overcoming the baggage of history, we have tried to suppress it. And that is sort of being realistic with our politics. I also think this goes into like why so many of our Marxist comrades have such a problem. They don't see what the praxis is to be derived from a Marxist theology. They have trouble understanding what he's doing. He is, in fact, rescuing many instances of praxis from history that Marxists have erased.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking about why that kind of answers our Chris's earlier question about why he's not as in vogue as Benjamin, or even though they're so aligned in this, to my mind.
100%. Like, my controversial take is that so is Adorno. Adorno is a utopian, right? Life cannot be lived, a wrong life cannot be lived rightly. Like, what is that if not a demand for a life that can be lived rightly, right? So it's a problem of method, a problem of style, and I think it is a suspicion of his overall project, which is this, is this call for a Marxist critique of Marxism, in some ways, right? And to kind of like reopen, like, this is why Heritage of Our Time is such an important book in Bloch's work. So it's in German, it's Erbschaft dieser Zeit, and it's kind of like a sociological report of Weimar era Germany. And he goes, okay, why did fascism win? And so the sort of standard critique is like, well, it's a trick of ideology, you know, people are believing the wrong things. And if they had the right facts in front of them, like, people would be convinced, and you know, the laws of mechanical history are on our side, and like, it'd be fine. And Bloch was like, actually, the phrase that he uses, which I really love, is that it's a swindle of revolution. That's what fascism is. You're promised something, and it's a promise that kind of speaks to these kind of like almost these unarticulatable dreams and desires that people have within them. And he goes through like every level of society you know, and says, like, here's what the fascists promised, you know, the middle manager or the board and, like, henpecked husband who's unhappy in his marriage. It's like, it's not that everything was going to be better, but you were promised, like, your dreams were kind of going to be realized by fascism. And Bloch kind of insists upon the necessity of going, those dreams and kind of inchoate drives and desires have political content to them. And if you allow reactionary politics to speak into that, you will end up in kind of a very dark situation. And if a kind of left politics can only constantly fall back on its like mechanical materialism and like the inescapable teleologies of history, then you don't have any praxis either.
Right.
And those, the mechanical materialism or the scientistic materialism at its worst, there's kind of it's neglect of really investigating fascism is directly related to its neglect of religion.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly. That's actually, I wrote down a question last night. I wanted to make sure that we could, I mean, this is a general question, but specifically it's a question I think for John is, what does it really mean, I think, just to be a theologian of Marxism, or I guess an atheist theologian? Like, if we can unpack that, because it sounds like a simple turn of phrase that's easy to ignore, but I think this conversation is starting to show just how much that means and how deep that could be if we really think about it.
So there's a great line in Atheism and Christianity where Bloch says that the point is not to kind of demythologize theology. The point is to de-theocratize it.
Yeah.
I love the thing that he says about the Bible, where he says that the Bible has always been the church's bad conscience.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
And he says, like, actually, religion is the opium of the masses. And then he kind of completes the actual quotation from Marx, which is about, it is the cry of the oppressed creature, you know, the soul of a soulless world, the mollification of pain. And he says, actually, if you try and just kind of hand wave away, do the Reddit atheism thing and go, you believe in this guy dad who tells you off. Bloch doesn't think that that's even a kind of necessary precondition of being religious, right? Instead, he says that actually there are kind of two kinds of ways of thinking about religion. You have the religion of capitalist ideology. You have the religion of the priest class, as he refers to it in Atheism and Christianity. But there is also this, there is the religion of, as he puts it, the religion of Exodus. And what is Exodus? It is the journey from bondage into liberation. Or to put it another way, it's a narrative of revolution. And it's incredibly important that it's a narrative of revolution that is practiced by the poor, right? That's how it's understood, you know, and he writes, sadly, it's a book that isn't translated into English yet. He writes really well about Thomas Münzner and this idea of Münzner's political commitments were the necessary consequence of his theological beliefs, right?
Right, they're not like two separate things married together.
Right,
no,
they're the same thing.
Yeah, like a really good modern example is Althusser, because Althusser is a fairly serious Catholic in his early life.
Oh yeah,
and then he joins the PCF. He joins the French Communist Party, and he says that this isn't the same thing as walking away from Catholicism. It's the fulfilling of Catholicism. It's the fulfilling of it. Isn't communism that famous Jameson's reversal? Right. Here's what it means to be a Marxist theologian, where he goes, oh, well, Marxist, it's just religion, you know, communism. That's just religion for people who don't want to go to church anymore. Right. And Jameson turns it around and goes, well, even if that's true, all religion is just simply a communism that hasn't recognized itself yet.
Yeah.
Right.
So good.
That's where we could find some use in reading Roland Bohr. he talks a lot about this. Our frenemy, Roland Bohr, is our favorite Stalinist.
he's actually in the Zizek Thompson. One of his essays is in that book. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's good on the the two strands of Christianity that exist in conflict with one another all throughout the Bible. And I think that he would agree with Block about the Bible being the conscience of the church, right?
Yeah, right. I think there's a quote from right at the end of Atheism and Christianity that I really love, where Block says, "Far from being a contradiction in terms, concrete utopia is the firmest of handholds, and by no means only where the propaganda and implementation of socialism is concerned. The whole surplus force of culture finds its salvation there, and these forces are becoming more and more relevant to us all the time. Above all, the wealth of artistic allegories and religious symbols, whose day is not yet done when the ideology which bore them disappears. An old sage once said that man is easier to save than to feed. The coming age of socialism will find, when everyone has sat down to the meal, that the conventional reversal of this paradox is very indigestible indeed, that man is easier to feed than to save. Taking everything into consideration, that is, ourselves and socialism and death and the crucial secret that there is, in fact, a world at all to be set straight. For the really enduring sort of self-alienation is not so dependent on the false society that will go when the society goes. Its sources lie deeper than that. Marx said, to be radical is to grasp things at their root. But the root of all things, social things, is man. The first letter of John 3:2 also takes man as the root, but rather as being on the way to something than as being a real cause. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure. The he admittedly refers to the so-called Father in heaven, but it is the Son of Man.
Son of Man. It's like,
yeah, like I feel like I want to say hallelujah right now.
Like, do you, because again, to put this back in the kind of like dismissal of like Reddit atheism, do you need the so-called God in heaven? No. What you need is the actual appearance of humanity in history for the first time.
Right.
Although I'm also so reading Atheism and Christianity, the fulcrum is on, he's very upfront about being atheist and about dethroning the sort of the authoritarian God in heaven. But, there's no reason that you should finish this book and come out if you are a believer in God. He seems to be mainly confronting you in how you believe in God.
Yes.
As opposed to whether or not. It's about what that means. And that is the fundamental distinction between resistance or acquiescence, as opposed to whether or not.
It's not like a God delusion, right?
Mm-hmm. No, there's actually a great, in the beginning, I was going to read this, if you don't mind, by Peter Thompson, quoting Block. He says that this would be not be out of place in a debate with Dawkins. Block says, "The point to be made against all pseudo-enlightenment, which sees religion as a spent force caught between Moses and Darwin, and also to be made against all misty ambivalence, is this. The counterblow against the oppressor is biblical too." And that is why it has always been suppressed or distorted from the serpent on.
Damn, yeah, that's going to have to be on my next up next to read list.
Yeah.
I have to, to kind of just bring this to back to the question of politics. It's like, what does that mean for like Marxism and Christianity, right? And again, this Block is actually incredibly useful if you go, what would it mean for there to be a kind of serious dialogue that did not end up compromising either of those things? And again, Block says, "True Marxism has no time for all this, but takes true Christianity seriously, too seriously for just another gray and compromising dialogue. When Christians are really concerned with the emancipation of those who labor and are heavy laden, and when Marxists retain the depths of the kingdom of freedom as the real content of revolutionary consciousness on the road to becoming true substance, the alliance between revolution and Christianity, founded in the peasant wars, may live again, this time with success. Florian Geyer, the great fighter of those wars, is reputed to have the words nulla crux, nulla corona, scratched on the blade of his sword. That could be a motto of a Christianity free at last from alienation. No crowns, no church.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Neither crown nor church.
Yeah, neither crown nor church, right? Because
nulla in Latin together means neither nor. So. No, but that's awesome.
That kind of makes me want to, leads me to the next thing, the next question I had, which is, it's really, well, it's not a question, but I guess I kind of want to talk a little bit about the distinctions and the uses of the concept of the no longer conscious and the not yet conscious, just because I feel like if we just sort of work that kind of thinking into our speech, it's very easily misunderstood, kind of like when you say dialectical too much without explaining yourself.
I think we kind of have to talk about, we have to deal with the Jung question, right? So a really common criticism of Bloch is like, all of this gets a bit mystic, right? It gets a bit mystical, a little bit. And I don't know about you, but that should make anybody kind of a little bit suspicious when we start talking about the esoteric and the kind of hidden realms of knowledge. I'm just sort of like, it sounds a little bit sad. Bloch is quite scathing about Jung and Freud, and refers to Jung as a psychoanalytical fascist. it's like scathing about Jung, because these Jungian ideas of the unconscious throw you back into yourself and into your past, right? What can you do? Is you confront the confront the shadow, you go out, you confront the shadow, you go through, you refuse, order is restored, right? It's psychic fascism, right? So in contrast, Bloch has this idea of no longer conscious and the not yet conscious, and the not yet conscious is part of this broader philosophical term of the nicht noch, the not yet, and the not yet conscious is the kind of like. I suppose the best analogy is the seed in the tree, right? Everything that the tree is contained within the seed. But the seed is not yet the tree. And it would be a mistake to say, oh, that seed is a tree, because it isn't. But everything that the tree will be is already present there within that seed. So his critique of Freud is sort of similar as well, is that Freud puts you back into your memories, puts you back into childhood. He says, well, Freudian dream analysis is like, it's all about what happened to you. He says that Freud is concerned with the dreams of the night, whereas hope is about the dreams of the day. The daydream is about the future. As it's young people, like it's teenagers who daydream, right? They sort of drift off in school and they're thinking about what are they going to do when they get out of here? Like that's the utopian dream. That's the not yet. That's the dreaming of the not yet. And so the not yet is not just this kind of like psychological thing, but it's also political. It's also philosophical, right? So he was asked to kind of sum up his philosophy, and he was like, S is not P. Subject is not yet. Predicate is like, that's Bloch's own sort of like feeling of his philosophy in its simplest terms. The working class is not yet the revolutionary proletariat, but the conditions for that revolution are always already present here. I think a good way of thinking about this is like the opposite of hope for Bloch is not fear. The opposite of hope is nostalgia. Why? Because nostalgia takes you backwards. Hope is sending you towards the future. And fear is also fear of what will happen, right? Something is coming for, like, so there's a futurity in fear as well. But memory and nostalgia are kind of antithetical in some ways to Bloch's philosophy of hope.
And he's constantly confronting this in atheism and Christianity, too, with regard to the interiority, the way that Christ, by John, is kind of premised as an interiority of the spiritual, as opposed to external, you know. Does this have to do with this term? I'm not going to try in German, of repurposing. Does this have to do with are these similar to Marx and Hegel? Hegelianize Marx, but to utopianize Hegel. Is that also what he's doing here with?
Yeah, 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 this unfunktioniert, this repurposing, where in fact all of history is no longer this thing which is exhausted, right? But contains possibilities within it that are. Sarcat's dog.
Who's dog?
Oh, that's just Ben not muting whenever he's.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's Ben not muting as usual.
Yeah, yeah, and actually, I just texted you, and I think Kevin and I made a mistake. I think the banging is also Ben. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyways,
I've been muted whenever I'm not talking.
Oh well.
Me too, because I've had a baby crying in the background. That's why I got up. I need to go check on the baby. Baby's fine.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah. Sorry, John, you were in the middle of a thought, though.
I was in the middle of a thought. History. So this, and again, it's about a kind of critique of this vulgar Marxist ideology, right? History is this kind of ruin. But in those ruins, you find things which are useful and kind of purposeful. And the bit that I quote from the from Bloch is that one gains additional revolutionary force from the incomplete wealth of the past, especially if it is not sublated in the last stage. The still subversive and utopian contents in the relation of people to people and to nature, which are not past because they were never quite attained, can only be of use in this way. These contents are, as it were, the gold-bearing gravel in the course of previous labor processes and their superstructure in the forms of works.
Yeah, see, I think that's a more, just a beautiful and more clear way of talking about some of the same kind of things that Benjamin talks about with, like, tigers and jumping through time and so on.
Yeah. But, like, Bloch knew what Benjamin was trying to do. Like, Bloch understood exactly what he was trying to do. And the great kind of, like, aphorism that Bloch uses is that, like, Marxism is both detective and liberator when it comes to a philosophy of history, right? If there is this smooth teleology that's either kind of liberally triumphalist or, you know, revolutionary triumphalist or liberally annihilationist and nihilistic, one of the three. And Bloch says, actually, that the kind of whole point is to unpick, you know, you don't really know what happened in history.
right.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I wrote in the margins of this section where you wrote the past could have been different. And if we understand those moments of possibility, that opens up the question of how the future can be different too, which is what we always refer to as lost horizons, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, right. Like the, and that, that's what Benjamin's talking about as well. And that's, I mean, I think that like everything that I'm finding out about Bloch that, because I've had done superficial readings of commentary on Bloch, but I've never actually just dug into Bloch, except for whenever we touched on it last time by reading one chapter in order to, for that discussion with you.
Yeah, John is responsible for basically turning everybody onto Bloch.
Well, I mean, it's basically like everything that we thought that we were thinking of on our own, Bloch already put out there. So it's coming to us diffused through, it's coming us diffused through the ether. There we go. How about that?
Yeah.
Right.
One of the things I also wanted to focus in on, and you just kind of mentioned this when you were talking about the teleology of sort of like liberal Whiggishness and then vulgar Marxism. And I wanted to like talk about how that ends up being a sort of reverse idealism that is on its own. And then at the same time, the sort of liberal optimism that a lot of the left engages in is sort of tied to this sort of Marxist teleology as well. And it sort of replaces it, right? I think that a lot of modern day leftists, a lot of modern Marxists, our contemporaries, aren't actually even vulgar Marxists so much as they are just Whiggish liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And their optimism, and as you write in this, ends up being functionally the exact same thing as nihilistic pessimism, because neither one of them think that we have to start over or we have to move through what it is that that is the obstruction that's keeping us from the utopian horizon, that we have to move through it.
Any optimist is really a pessimist in disguise, or a pessimist in bad faith, right?
Right.
Because you it's like you're an optimist, you look at the world and this is it. This is all you wanted, right?
Right.
This is what you wanted.
But what if you call it revolutionary optimism?
That's what Yevtushenko refers to when he talks about the constant flexing of the biceps for all to see, but it's meaningless otherwise. It's just showing off, and it's really mostly showing off to yourself.
Or the 14 people in your echo chamber on social media, right?
Right.
Anyone got any other questions or comments?
Well, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the again, this is a very poorly formulated question, but I wrote, how might Bloch help us to rethink and reconceptualize and so on? I guess what I mean is just is it really that simple? It's just everybody should read Bloch more? Or is there some way in which, the entry point, what's the way in which it can become obvious and can sort of take on a life of its own, besides reading this primer, which is excellent?
Okay, so it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, right?
Right.
Yeah,
it's very easy to imagine that.
The Blochian response is we have to work on our imagination.
That's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, right? It's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Why? And if the end of capitalism means the end of this world, then so be it, right? Because the Blochian response is, what's next? What comes next? And I actually think, these resources are so useful around, I think there's a lot that we could bring up here, but I think particularly around eco-socialism and ecological communism, degrowth socialism, the kind of work that's come out from people like Sophie Lewis on family abolition, right? These ideas of what would it mean? What does a kind of genuine humanity, to put it in a block slightly old-fashioned terminology, what does that look like now, right? I think those are two really promising areas in which you have people asking the kind of utopian question of what's next? What can we do both in and against the world?
Yeah, that's a good answer. I like that.
Is this in relation to reality being a subject-object process and
And an incomplete process, right? I said this last night at the book launch, when it's sort of there's this weird kind of cultural feeling at the moment where everything feels very, very fragile and yet at the same time almost inevitable, right? You look at a really good example is it's an election year, right? So and you go, we don't know how this is going to go. But also, it was inevitable that it was always going to be
right.
Biden. Right? It feels like no matter what we did, there was a kind of just inertia. And I think thinking about the horrific violence and murders in Palestine is a really good example about this. Right? The world feels just on the question of life. Is the world livable? It feels so fragile and so deeply unstable. And at the same time, these kind of great systemic forces seem to have this kind of almost immovable, everything feels contingent and so steel laden at the same time. And I think there is this kind of new blockage that we have kind of hit culturally, where what we need is we need this kind of catalyzing imaginative potential to think through this, because the answers that are immediately at hand are not working. You saw huge global protests, and the last decade, I think, is a really good example of experiments in horizontalism and global protest movements. Vincent Bevan's new book is very good on this.
Right.
And Bevins brings up the point that none of this worked, right?
Yeah.
These movements were co-opted, or they collapsed, or they were exhausted. But those experiments are worth something, mm-hmm. because they reopen what for Bloch is the formative question. And we started talking about this of what is to be done, right? That's the question, is how do we live? And of course, this is the Leninist question. And for Bloch, and this is maybe why we need to think beyond Bloch, for Bloch, he never wrote a utopian manifesto, right? He never wrote the utopian program because he thought he had seen it. He thought he saw it.
Right.
And I think our problem is that so often we kind of go backwards for the old utopian program where we go, oh, well, we just need the Leninist party again, or we just need the 1968 movement again. And it's like, instead, I really love Bloch's image of the gold bearing gravel, right? Like our job is to find these things, but not to just try and reenact them. But to, and again, this is Marx in the 18th Brumaire, right? This tradition that weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living, but we repurpose those tools. And I think we're probably due to a return to those Leninish questions of like strategy and organization and like mass groups of people that will have some sort of structure. But like, this is not to say that like what we need is 1917. What we need, like,
right.
the choice, the why read Bloch now is to see the kind of historical record and to be prompted to ask the necessary question of, like, what's next?
I feel it. So utopian studies has been around a bit, you know, and I often find, initially I had great enthusiasm, but I often find that it has spends more time in subjective experience than in objective reality. I mean, there's reasons why those case studies, Bivens profiles, fail. He gives a really great accounting of that. But what I think the Blochian, you know, mandate is to reclaim utopian projects into a way that can intervene into objective reality to change all subjective experience. And I just wonder why. Maybe it's a real politic question. Maybe it's a Leninist question. But I just wonder why so much of the utopian kind of politics, whether it's communization or whatever, have been kind of relegated to almost lifestyle, you know?
Yeah. I think this is why. So like between the 30s and the 60s, Bloch and Adorno had like this series of sometimes maybe slightly spiky conversations about utopia. And in the 60s, like Adorno says, it's Bloch who's restored honor to the concept of utopia. And I completely agree with you. And I think I am not hugely enamored with a lot of utopian studies. I think it collapses into like very passive liberalism of like utopia is when nice things happen. But like even in academic utopian studies, you still have, I've gone to at least one conference where like you could see people like Darko Suvin or Ruth Levitas or Tom Moylan, the utopians who go, some of us are still Marxists, you know? And it's like, this is like, you're right, we have to reclaim utopia, but it has to be reclaimed as a Marxist idea, right? Organized along these principles of the structuring thoughts of like the class struggle, of historical materialism, of the abolition of private property. And those are lived experiences, of course, but those are politically and socially mediated. And I think it's very telling that we live in an age which has depoliticized those. Oh, it's lifestyle, as if the social question is not inherently a political question.
Right.
Huh. Well.
But to finish my thought is like, I brought up Adorno and Bloch's conversations around utopia, and I actually think our situation is much worse. The problem is not like what kind of utopia are we aiming for? The problem is utopian philosophy thinkable at all now?
Right.
And I think in the popular imagination, the answer to that question is no. Right.
Right.
What is on offer? One, managed decline of various levels of competency in which things will gradually get worse. You know, it will be the apocalypse that Fisher writes about, talking about Children of Men, right? You will live through it. Or there has to be the kind of like, we have to reopen the question of utopianism as a serious like imperative. And I think this is incredibly difficult to do. This is, you know, if this like little cheap book does anything, I hope it's to kind of like insist upon We have to. It's not that we need a philosophy of hope, right? That's Bloch's job. We have to hope for hope, right? That's
yeah.
Like, because this is Utopia is a joke, right? It's a kind of like, it's like a sick joke. When you look, like, I keep quoting Brecht's poem to posterity, where he says, like, a conversation about trees is almost a crime because it implies silence about so many other things.
Right.
Right. But it's like, to think of utopia as a crime, but it's also like the only, there is this kind of contradiction within it, which is like what makes it necessary. You go, isn't it so awful to think of utopia because of all of these terrible things which are happening? And it's like, yes, because of that, we have to think about utopia. Right. We have to take seriously the utopia, the demand of like actually a world that's worth living in.
Hence rescuing the past, right? Like, yes. That's, you say the history is not finished, the present is incomplete, and the future is still to be determined. And one of Bloch's central philosophical claims here is that this is true of the past, too. Mm-hmm. And that I think that's a stumbling block for a lot of people, because this positivist linear movement through time is so naturalized in lived experience, you know?
That's why I really like the way that you end the third, I guess it's the third chapter or whatever. It's Marxism and the Politics of Utopian Struggle. Mm-hmm. You say that the struggle now or, you know, whatever, for our time, is not for utopia. Rather, our position, far bleaker, is to try and make utopianism thinkable in the terms of Bloch outlines. Mm-hmm. And that's just like, damn, that's just so hard hitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we lament the loss of the utopian horizon all the time. Turns out what we were doing was just being Blochian on accident.
Yeah, I think that lament is like, it's also the ground in which you what's Bloch's response? Start again.
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
Like, why? Because you'll always be starting again. What is it you're trying to get back to? You're trying to get back, as he puts it, we're all trying to return to Heimat. We're trying to get back home. Right. And that's that feeling of when, like, actually the world kind of makes sense to us.
Right.
But what do? You always leave home. And so right. Like, this is the kind of, like, the challenge that it isn't. And, like, the lamenting of it is the first part of that gesture. And then you go, okay, start again. Because that's what we'll always be doing. You know, he's a process philosopher. And he says... process will be made by the people who are made by the process.
Yes. At the foot of the lighthouse, there is no light.
Yeah. When you're like, you want to see light, you set off, you have to go, you have to leave.
Right.
So I think if this is, there's this idea of like, don't mourn, organize, like as if mourning is not like a kind of essential first part of the ground clearing for something new to emerge. But it's like, if all we do is the lament, then I think we've missed, again, it's that second half of the utopian dialectical move, which is, given all that we know about history, given all that we know about the great kind of charnel house of catastrophe and failure and all of these unrealized
bench of history.
Possibility, are you prepared to try that again? Which is like the great kind of gamble of utopianism.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on.
Yeah, that is. I was about to say, well, we could end right there if no one else has anything insightful to add or any pertinent questions.
No, I mean, the only other thing I would want to do is just make sure that we tell people like how to find the book and to go look for it.
Right. We didn't mention that this book is on Zero and is part of a series on Utopia. Mm-hmm. So go to Zero Books. I mean, like... it's just Zero Books on everything. Zero Books on Facebook, Zero.Books on Instagram, Zero with a zero for an O on X, formerly Twitter, or Zero Repeater on TikTok. But yeah, I mean, Zero Books. It's good because John's publishing on it. So
yeah.
John, your short book is so necessary, you know, because I do think Bloch is talking to lived experience in a way that readers of, not only readers of theory, but just people who are interested in this line of, this kind of inquiry will be not used to. I mean, Bloch, he's the kind of writer that he's very associative. He'll use Latin. He's not going to explain what he's saying, right? So your book is like incredibly needed as an entryway into this thinker.
Right.
Yeah, there's one final like quote from Block that I've been thinking about a lot through the course of this conversation. It's from the beginning of the third volume of The Principle of Hope. From early on, we want to get to ourselves, but we do not know who we are. All that seems clear is that nobody is what he would like to be or could be. Hence the common envy, namely of those who seem to have, in fact, to be what we are entitled to. But hence also the desire to start something new, which begins with ourselves. Attempts have always been made to live commensurately with ourselves. We have in us what we could become.
Amen.
Без нас некому будет установить порядок, определить работу, труду. Без нас все развалится, все распадется.